fix you some eggs.
Oh, hon, you can sleep.
Gotta eat a breakfast. I'll fix you some eggs.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Cinecurious, the one about Fargo. My name is Jaina Poundmore.
And I'm Trash.
And we are joined this week by a special guest, Bernice Python. Welcome, Bernice.
Hey.
That's Happy your government here. Name, by the way, right?
For sure. Absolutely.
So I don't know if we've talked about this yet, Trash, but our whole like little friend collective here is kind of centered around the roller derby community. I'm pretty sure, you know, we haven't touched on it, but obviously, like, my last name's not Poundmore and your parents loved you more than to name you Trash.
I hope so.
So we all use what's called the derby names here on the podcast.
Yes, our derby-given names, not our God-given, our derby-given, which is more important.
So this is Cinecurious, the podcast where we watch the top 250 movies of all time. And we're going in reverse, you know, 250 to 1 to make it more interesting. And we're coming back and talking about each of those. We are at number 249 on our list now. And this is Fargo, the 1996 Coen Brothers vehicle.
And what an interesting vehicle it was. It's definitely a classic. Definitely a classic. Lots of memes online about it. I don't know. Anybody else want to chime in?
So, Bernice, when I was telling you that, you know, our next episode was going to be Fargo, you showed interest in it. So what was that passion? What brings you back to Fargo every time?
Honestly, being from the Midwest is just that it's an endearing movie to me because it's familiar, I guess you could say, being small town, growing up in a small town.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's so much of the nomenclature that's used in this movie. Well, the Coen brothers, you know, were the ones that wrote the film. They are both from Minnesota, which stands to reason if one of them's from Minnesota and they're brothers. But just like some of the words that are used there and when the mention of, supper's ready, like you don't hear the term supper outside of the Midwest typically, you know?
I wouldn't know. I haven't been outside of the Midwest in many a day.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with you on that, Jaina. And I think that's a big reason why I really enjoy this movie is because it's like watching family kind of. Not that my family would ever put somebody in a chipper.
Oh, come on.
I don't know, never say never.
True enough.
A great part of this movie too, and it's one of the more known parts, and maybe it's just because it looks like it's just, you know, spraying like a sprinkler head out of the end of that thing.
That was amazing the way they filmed that. That was just so absurd. You just had to laugh at it.
Absolutely.
My favorite
is when he's.
Go ahead, Bernice.
My favorite is when he's trying to jam that in there, and he kind of backs up, and all you see is that foot kind of wobbling around in there.
So. With that wood chipper, I was reading a bit of trivia here where the chipper's actually on display at the Fargo like tourist center or something like that. They have it out front.
Why wouldn't it be? I mean,
that's an interesting piece of film memorabilia though, to have on display. So if the people haven't seen the movie, and of course, this is the part where we say fair warning, we're going to spoil the shit out of it. So if you haven't seen the movie though, it's about a man versus himself movie basically with William H. Macy, where he's trying to have his wife kidnapped so that he can split the ransom money with these people that he's hiring to kill his wife. So the or not to kill his wife, to kidnap his wife. The kidnappers are Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare. Peter Stormare is at the wood chipper after the inevitable double cross, and he's stuffing Steve Buscemi into the chipper. And so then the police officer, played by Frances McDormand, comes up and catches him in the act. And hilarity and blood spews everywhere.
Yeah, there's it's an interesting movie because it takes these scenes where normally you'd think you're supposed to be disgusted by them, but like they're so hilariously presented, so absurdly presented, I should say, that like you can't do anything but laugh at the absurdity.
You know, that's one of the first things that really caught my mind when I was sitting down to watch this movie again today. You know, taking a look at, you know, what's in front of, or rather not taking a look, but knowing what's in front of you when you watch this movie. You know, Coen brothers, obviously, you know, they're known for great dialogue in their films. Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou? Great, Big Lebowski, so on and so forth. Fargo is absolutely no different. As a matter of fact, you know, that's why they've won awards for this thing for best screenplay. But so you know that there's going to be some goofiness coming up in the dialogue and in the story that you're about to watch. But the music in the opening is so dramatically epic. It is insane.
Yeah, the score to this movie is something else. And some of the shots, too, there like goes from like absurd to like very artsy, very... I don't know how to describe it. It's just, it's very interesting, the juxtaposition of, like, taking the movie takes itself seriously for a second, and then it's like, okay, we're off the rails.
So with a big part of this, you know, I think all of us having that nostalgia feel because Midwesternness, it's, you know, all of us are in the Midwest, we're from here, and we have this connection to these characters in a roundabout sort of way. How much of it, Bernice, in your opinion, do you think is like, okay, well, they're going to be serious for a second, but then it's going to get goofy. Is that for comedic effect, do you think? Or is this the Coen saying like, no, this is what people are like around here. Like, we'll take things seriously, but we're also kind of idiots at times.
Yeah, that's really an interesting question, because after I watched the movie again, I went through and I was reading a bunch of just comments from different people who had watched the movies from all different years. And what struck me is there was a lot of people who are really put off by the dialogue and having that heavy Midwestern accent. And there was a lot of people that assumed that that accent was part of the comedy. And I don't know that that was, it probably was a part of the intention from the Coen brothers, and I'm totally just giving you my opinion on it, mm-hmm. I guess. But that was probably a little bit of the intention there, because that heavy Midwestern accent really is kind of ridiculous in its own right. But that's also very true to that area. So... you know, it kind of, and I guess this is, again, why I liked it so much, is it gave me that very real world, like I was watching a true story.
Right.
Yeah.
I was seeing where the actors, they all read this book called How to Talk Minnesotan to help with their accents on this, which I believe is a farcical book. But they were all using this to help them out with their accents on the set.
That's,
I suppose, it was 95. Like, you couldn't just hop on YouTube and be like, oh, how does this go?
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's not as recognizable as an accent as, like, Scottish or English.
True.
So, and we, when you mentioned, you know, the true story part of it, and it's funny because this movie opens up saying that it's based on a true story of events from 1987. The interesting part there is it's not, though. And I didn't realize that until today, to be honest with you.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You didn't? Oh. I guess because you watch the movie and you're like, okay, these guys are serious. Come on, this is definitely... they wouldn't lie to us, right?
Well, I mean, I thought it was like everything else in Hollywood. It's like anytime you watch something quote-unquote based on a true story, like, it's loosely based on the events of a story that happened, but obviously they don't have the dialogue. You know, they don't know that the guy that sort of looks like Will Smith walked across the room and grabbed a glass of water at this exact point in the conversation. That's just not a thing. But no, I thought that it was like legit loosely based around like an actual news story with some guy who tried to have his wife kidnapped so he could collect the inheritance. And turns out the only part of it that's even remotely based on a true story is the shoving the person in the wood chipper of all things.
Of course, why not?
I did read an article because I had found that same thing interesting, Jaina, that it really wasn't all that true, even though it was presented to be a true story. But I did read one article that did say that the element of the car salesman using the VIN numbers to kind of defraud GM was also a piece of truth.
That had.
Yeah.
But nobody really died because
nobody died of it because of it.
Not that we know of.
Yeah, I suppose.
So the part that it's funny, the first place that we are in the movie is Fargo, right? Movie opens on Fargo and there's a William H. Macy pulling up in his car to a seedy kind of bar called the King of Clubs. Has like almost a strip club feel to it. So I thought, I every time I look at it, I think the sign says King of Chubs.
Who knows?
So he goes in the...
Sorry.
He hops in there, hops into the King of Chubs and hires these guys to kidnap his wife. And it's from that point on that things like pretty quickly go off the rails then. I mean, this is a really weird situation to begin with somebody who's, I mean, in the opening moments saying, we're going to come in here and have you, we're going to introduce you to a character who loves his wife, but he's going to have her kidnapped. He doesn't want anything bad to happen to her, mind you, though. But he's going to have her kidnapped.
Why not?
Right.
For a measly sum of $40,000.
Oh, gosh.
Well, that's the cool thing with this, is in that opening scene, the Coens introduce us to the rules of the game right away. You know, it's, hey, here's this guy. He's kind of dopey. He's, you know, pretty innocent. It appears, by all intents and purposes, that's played by William H. Macy. He's meeting up with these kidnappers who, you know, said, meet us in this bar, Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare. And they say, you know, okay, well, you know, we're going to, why are we doing this? And he's talking about, oh, well, I don't know. That's kind of personal. I don't think I should be talking about that. and then they find out, okay, well, it's $80,000 total. So you're only going to get $40,000 of this. So that kind of feels like robbing Peter to pay Paul. But it sets up the movie in such a way that it's just like, okay, I know where we're going here. Strap in.
Very true.
Yes. Yeah. And then, I was going to say something. Now it's gone out of my head. I apologize.
Sorry, I'm chewing.
I find it interesting that very quickly that sum of money that was the ransom amount went from that 80 grand to $1 million.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Go. No, all you, girl.
Oh, I was just going to say the fact that he's trying to get a ransom off of his father-in-law because he's too embarrassed to ask for money from him. And then the scheme that he builds up, it's just so ridiculous.
Why don't you talk about, you know, how that scheme is and what that part is all about, Trash, to people that haven't seen. We kind of touched on it a little bit, but.
I don't know if I'm the best at describing it, but his little scheme that he thinks is bulletproof, he hires these hitmen to kidnap his wife, and then he's going to ransom his wife to his father-in-law and get the money that way, and hopefully nobody finds out anything. That is the grand scheme. Clearly it does not go over the way he hopes it will, but that's just like a rough idea of what he's trying to think he can do.
The father-in-law played by the fantastic Harv Presnell. Love that guy and everything that he's in. Yes. He's got one of those faces where it's like, I know him, but I couldn't tell you his name or what he's been in. Thank you, IMDb.
Right.
But so here's the part that I wasn't sure on. And so when we meet William H. Macy's character, it's first in the bar, and then we're quickly introduced to his family. He comes home and his wife is making supper. And his boy is sitting there and they're all gathered around the table. The father-in-law is watching what is it, the Minnesota Gophers?
Gophers.
Watching the hockey team. And we quickly find out that William H. Macy's character is trying to get this investment opportunity going. Wade, who, you know, the father-in-law, he's got a business. I guess I'm not entirely sure what all the business does. Is it just like he's a rich guy that has multiple investments? Because he also owns the car dealership that William H. Macy works for.
I think that's the gist of it.
Okay.
Don't quote me on it, but that's what it seems to imply.
So yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, yeah, I agree. I think it's kind of like a developer kind of a business where they find property and acquire it and then develop it into some sort of either commercial or residential or whatever. That's the kind of feel that I got from that.
Okay, so that makes a lot more sense, because William H. Macy's thing that he's trying to get going is get the father-in-law to essentially give him a loan to invest in, what is it, 40 acres? So he wanted to do what, turn it into a parking lot?
That's what I thought he said, but it never made sense to me of, like, how is this such a good business proposition if he's just making a parking lot?
Right. I mean, you know, I don't know. What's the parking situation like in Minneapolis?
Not terrible, I didn't think.
So I think that's the funny thing, too, is we have these really convoluted backstories for everybody. And, you know, these schemes that people are working on to try and get ahead and get to where they want to be. But we don't actually find out any of the details about, like, why, you know, we don't really get into the deepness of the characters in why do they want these things? Why does he want to get this opportunity going? We kind of get some hints at it. You know, I get the feeling that the father-in-law is, I don't get the feeling. It's pretty blatant that the father-in-law doesn't really care for William H. Macy and looks down on him anyway, because there's that comment where he says to him, oh, you know, what's the Gene? I can't. What's the boy's name? Do you guys remember?
I can't remember.
Steve? Oh, I could be wrong.
Sure, let's just say Ian, and then he's just like, Scotty. Oh, yeah, you know, this could be a huge opportunity, huh?
It's Scotty, I do believe.
Scotty. You're right. This could be a huge opportunity for Gene and Scotty and I, and we'd never have to worry again. And the father-in-law says, Gene and Scotty never have to worry anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so that's how it is. And it was at that moment that I kind of sympathized with William H. Macy, because I've had in-laws like that.
Yeah, there's some nasty. Yeah,
do you guys think that's part of a Midwestern thing, too, as far as that pride in being able to take care of your family and not have to ask for help? And you know, kind of like saving face by going and asking his stepfather, or not his stepfather, but his father-in-law, to help them out with money? You know, I guess my family and what I have seen, that's kind of a big thing, is like we're not really readily going to go to somebody and say, hey, give me this huge large sum of money, because it's kind of a point of pride.
I could see that at this. It's hard for me to say whether it's a Midwest thing or not, considering I'm a Midwesterner. Yeah. But I do also think that there's a big part of, like, male pride that gets in the way there. Because it's the role of the provider. It's that stereotypical, like, you know, I'm going to go hunt fish and provide.
Well, then I think that even can go further. That's like an American fundamental American thing. Like, traditional American families, traditional American, not people, but like citizens, like that's the ideal, is like you are self-sufficient, you don't ask for help, you do it on your own, and you're weak if you ask. But it does follow into the masculine, the toxic masculinity kind of deal where we don't ask for help, but we do it on our own kind of deal.
I kind of feel like it's a which came first, chicken and the egg, only it's which That's came true. First, the patriarchy or the ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. That's true.
But no, that's an interesting thought, Bernice. So yeah. As we keep going along on this, we get introduced to a couple other interesting characters, I think, some of which make appearances in the Fargo TV show. Have either of you seen the TV show?
I have not.
I have not either.
I've been meaning to, but...
I haven't either, so I have no idea. But I did see some stuff where, like, hey, a lot of these characters are showing up in the TV show, too. Oh, okay, well, that's interesting. But some of these characters are introduced to us in really weird ways. The Blue Ox. We want to talk about the Blue Ox for a second. Because it's a... So, Frances McDormand, she plays the police chief, and she's trying to solve the chief... Who's the body that they found in the car, by the way, at the beginning?
That's a good question.
It was just like their previous job, wasn't it?
I think so. I want to say so, but I'm not 100% positive.
Frances McDormand's character gets involved with this because she gets a call that there's been a murder out in a field somewhere. So I think that body that they find was like the Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare's last victim that they were paid to take care of. But anyway, so we get in as Frances McDormand is going through and trying to solve, you know, who solved that murder. By the way, she doesn't know about the kidnapping because, you know, they didn't want to go to the police. Obviously, William H. Macy didn't want to go to the police because, you know, less of a chance of getting caught, but said, no, they're being real clear. No police. It's got to be just us or they'll kill her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But she ends up at the Blue Ox, which is a motel near Fargo. And I just wrote Blue Ox scene. What's the point? Because in one shot, you have the Blue Ox here, and it's just like establishing the scenery shot. Here's the hotel. And then the next shot, it's, you know, the two queen beds in the hotel room and the two guys are sitting there having sex with a couple of prostitutes, and then it goes out, and then it just comes back and they're watching TV, and then it goes out. Like, I don't understand that scene. Like, first of all, is that common? Like, do you think people that travel together are just like having sex with like other people and like they're just all in the room together like that? Because that was really weird to me, first of all. Second of all, why did we even need this scene?
I think it was partly to show more on the characters, those two characters.
I got nothing out of this scene.
I'm trying to justify it, but I don't know.
Do you think it was only so that there was that little bit of introduction to the two, the two girls she interviews later, who were the two that they were having sex with at the time. So kind of placing those two girls in a little bit more context in a very choppy way.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah.
It definitely like makes you think about who those characters are. Like, I remember Blue Ox. Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I took from it. I guess when I was watching it, I was like, oh, they're just showing us that, okay, yes, there's these two girls. And then later on, you see those two girls when she's interviewing them.
So let's talk about that scene for a second, where she's interviewing these two girls. Oh my gosh, these women.
Go Bears.
It feels like every classmate of mine that didn't leave town, that is like, that's them. I hate to say it, but like, oh my gosh.
It's very... Talk about where you did community college for a minute.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
The part that I loved throughout this is she's trying to describe, you know, what he looks like. Oh, he was funny looking. He was uncircumcised, I can tell you that much.
Like, thank you. We all needed to know that. Oh, and on the previous murders beforehand, that was when the two hitmen encountered a police officer, and they had already kidnapped what's-his-face's wife. I know his name. I just, oh, my brain.
The William H. Macy character, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Jerry. Isn't it Jerry?
Jerry. Yeah, Jerry.
Lunderdart.
Yeah, that's right. Jerry's wife, they had her in the back of the car, and the cop pulled them over, saw they were suspicious, and one of the guys shot him. And then there was another car with two passengers that witnessed it, and then they chased him down, ran him off the road, and shot him as they escaped the car. That's what Margie was looking into.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, I derailed it and went a little further back, but I just
perfectly fine. Oh, another fun piece of trivia. Speaking of, the person that passes by in that car and sees what's going on and makes the weird face, I forget his name, but he was actually the storyboard artist for this movie and for Big Lebowski.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. I thought
Did you guys see the credits for his name?
No. Oh, yeah.
The sideways prince, formerly known as Prince Simple. But I guess they put a little smiley face in the circle part. I was like, wait, what is that?
This wasn't in this. Wait a minute. Why is it sideways? Wait a minute.
Yeah. I literally looked it up. I was like, this is bizarre.
The part that I thought was so weird was, you know, getting back to the scene with the interview that Margie's doing is how she keeps going back to, no, he was funny looking. No, really funny looking, like funnier than most.
Oh yeah, like how?
Well, let's just call a spade here. Steve Buscemi's a funny looking dude.
Yeah.
And it's Steve Buscemi that she's talking about here.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I got to thinking, like, okay, was that part written before it was Steve Buscemi? Or did they add that after they knew they got Steve Buscemi because he's funny looking?
That's a good very good question.
I don't know.
Right?
Huh.
Inquiring minds want to know.
So, Coen brothers, gotta get back to us.
What about the Friar Tuck scene? Does this tug on the nostalgia strings for anybody else? It's like the cafeteria style buffet that they go to.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a thing anywhere else, but around the Midwest, those cafeteria style buffets where like you would go there and like the dining room area was pretty nice, but it was straight up like a cafeteria with a tray where you go up and get like your salad and pudding. We're everywhere around here.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, they were.
I am so glad they started to disappear. I'm sorry.
I don't know. And you had like your Ponderosas where you could get like a steak too. So then a little while later, we get another gratuitous sex scene.
Yeah.
I wrote this one into my notes here just because I loved it. You know, getting back to the accent that we were talking about. She's, again, another prostitute with Steve Buscemi again. And she's so uninterested with it. And she's just like, come on.
Oh god!
It's like the next time I'm in bed with somebody, I'm just gonna be like, come on.
Right.
It was almost like she was encouraging like a puppy to, you know, start swimming or something. You can do it. Come on.
Very true.
Oh my gosh.
So one other interesting bit of trivia here that I found is, of course, the film itself was up for multiple awards. It won two Oscars. One of them that it was nominated for, though, what was it? It was Best Screenplay it won for, and Frances McDormand won for Best Actress. Another one of the awards that it was up for, though, was for Best Editing. The interesting thing with the editing is the person who was nominated for editing is Roderick James, who's also the editor for, I believe it was Big Lebowski. The interesting thing with that is Roderick James doesn't exist. He's actually a pseudonym for the Coen brothers, but they thought it was kind of egotistical to have their names all over the credits. So they came up with a pseudonym because they wanted to edit their own movie.
Nice.
That's funny. Nice.
But like they were sitting here like, oh, geez, what do we do if we get if we win the Oscar? Like, who goes up there? And I guess they had like some plan to have somebody from their movies in it. I don't know. This is what you guys tune into, everybody. It's this hard hitting trivia on these films that we love. It's all these rich details.
Oh, yeah. Indeed. Indeed. But that is interesting and kind of clever because. Sometimes when they're making these movies, you don't get to pick who edits your film. That's the production company. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you just want to edit your own goddamn film, you know?
I especially think that's true of the Coen brothers because they had such a clear direction with their stories and their movies. I could see them being concerned that their whole aesthetic that they're building would be disrupted if they had somebody else doing the editing.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point too. And I think that's pretty common with all of their films too. I mean, a Coen brothers movie is very unique from most other movies.
Oh yeah. They're very, yeah, you can definitely tell a Coen brothers film from another film for sure. Even within like the first without credits and stuff, even within like the first 10 minutes of the movie, you're like, oh, okay, this is one of those movies,
right? So taking a look at the awards here, of course, it's something that we take a look at just because, hey, these are supposedly the top 250 movies of all time, so we want to know what else we got. So we did talk about Best Actress in a Leading Role with Frances McDormand. We did talk about Best Screenplay in the Coens themselves. The other nominations that it got for Oscars was Best Picture. William H. Macy was up for Best Actor in a Supporting Role. Joel Coen got Director Cinematography for Walter Deakins. And Best Film Editing, as was mentioned, was Roderick James. Overall, the movie did get 83 wins and 58 nominations total for this. So I'm thinking the way they do that is it's like 83 plus 58. So it won 80... You know, those 83 wins, I guess it would have had to have been nominated to win those 83 times, too. Is that correct?
I would assume so. Because how can you win something if you're not nominated?
Right. Taking a look at the scores on it that filter into our movie review notes. As you know, we take our scores from Metacritic, IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, all of those places. Metacritic had an 85% score for Fargo. IMDb with the second highest at 8.1 out of 10, and Rotten Tomatoes, the overall score is quite high, and this is the winner on the scores this week at 94% fresh for Fargo. As far as across demographics, it was pretty common. There wasn't a huge, 2-point difference like there was in demographic with ratings, like there was between men and women with our last movie that we watched, Central Station. In this case, across all ages, it did garner an 8.1, like we mentioned, out of 10 on IMDb, with males rating it an 8.1 and females rating it an 8.0. The interesting thing about that is when you're looking at the demographic for males versus females, only 66,000 females have rated this film, whereas over 400,000 guys have.
Wow.
I didn't look at this thing. I didn't look at the statistics on Central Station to see what that one looked like as far as those numbers. But I have to wonder if just part of that is like, as women, we're just like, no, I have better things to do than go online and rate movies.
It
says
could be
the woman who's doing a movie podcast.
I mean, it could very well be, because I've watched movies, I'm like, I should rate this somewhere, and then I'm like, no, there's no time for that.
Mm-hmm.
No patience. And then you have these hardcore, like, cinemaphile guys that just rate every single movie they've ever watched ever since the dawning of their movie viewing time. I don't know. I like movies, but I'm not that into them.
Oh, and I mean, hey, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing what we do, because we are cinecurious. How's that for a transition? Coming up on our next episode of Cinecurious, it is going to be the 1958 Orson Welles film, Touch of Evil. I know nothing about this movie. Do either of you know anything about this? Have either of you seen this?
I've heard of it, but I've never watched it.
Huh.
But I do love a good Orson Welles.
Well, we're going to be keeping the Derby family love going in a couple weeks with the head ref of Kingsford Crush Roller Derby, the infallible Irony Man, joining us for this Orson Welles film, also starring Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh. So you can check us out September 7th for that episode. Unfortunately, that one's not free anywhere. It's not streaming for free, but it is rentable on Amazon, Apple, YouTube, and Vudu. Of course, you want to make sure that you're following us on Cinecurious Pod, or at Cinecurious Pod on Twitter and on Instagram. And also check out The Real Stats, the team who put together our top 250 list that you can find here in the show notes. Before we get out of here, let's go to our guest, the fantastic Miss Bernice Python. Final thoughts on Fargo, lady?
10 out of 10. Would watch again.
and likely will.
I have.
How about you, Trash?
Oh, I love Fargo. I think the first time I watched it was in college, and I've just, every year or two or a couple months or something, I'll get the urge to watch it, and it's fun to just turn it on and let the chaos ensue.
It's one of those movies that I told you in the pre-show I actually didn't watch until just a few years ago, and I've watched it a ton since then, so I'm hoping that pattern is going to continue with the rest of them as we keep going on this Cinecurious journey from 250 to 1, and I find a bunch of other movies that I've never seen and quickly become favorites of mine. Again, we will see you back here in 2 weeks on September 7th for Touch of Evil from Orson Welles. Until then, this is Jaina Podmore on behalf of Bernice Python and Sailor Trash saying we'll see you next time.
Bye!